We've been waiting a few minutes because, you know, people are late, but also the rain makes people even later, so I'm hoping that everyone's here. We've got a full house, which is really nice. And I apologize for the weather.
Not your fault.
But I'm so glad that, you know, pretty well everybody who registered for tonight indeed came. So I think that's a tribute to the dynamism of our speaker. Don't laugh. Oh, hey, hi, John.
Hi.
Joe, come in, please. See, the longer you wait, the more people come. It's amazing. Really pleased to have Des Morton as our speaker tonight. These sessions that we have two or three times a year are new for the past couple of years. The invitations go out to friends of the library or donors of the library also. And so that the attendance is restricted, if you like. They're, I would say, exclusive events. Not just small, but exclusive. You see the company you keep, Des? So it's very nice to see so many people here, but I know it's because the speaker is Des Morton. Des, as it turns out, is not just a professor. The list is too long, I just can't remember. He's a scholar, of course, a professor, an author, and a media expert. I love that. Born in Calgary, he's a military historian, as we all know, more about this later, but he attended Collège Militaire Royal in Saint-Jean. He also attended the Royal Military College in Kingston, was it Kingston at that point? So, learned military history from an early age. He's a Rhodes Scholar, went to Oxford University, and then the LSE. He is McGill's Professor of History Emeritus, the Hiram Mills Professor of History Emeritus. He's still teaching, so he may be emeritus, but he hasn't left the field. For 8 years, he was principal of Arundel College in Toronto at U of T. And then came back, I guess, or came to Montreal as founding director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. He's the author of over 40 books, a wide-ranging interest in history, military history, not just the war aspects, but the social and the political and other conditions of military history and life. And one of the things that I, when reading about him, I really loved was that in 2010 he received the Pierre Burton Award, which honors those who brought Canadian history to a wider audience, which I really like. This is us, we're the wider audience. The connection for today is we are in rare books and special collections of McGill's library, and there is a big collection of books, memorabilia, etc., of World War I particularly, I think, also World War II, and so Des is going to make a connection for us on one of the subjects about which he is a great expert. So I'm looking hugely forward to hearing what he has to say. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Desmond Morton.
About expectations being raised, but I'll do my best, and when you stop, when I stop, you applaud, or you applaud that I'm more grateful that I've stopped. I want to publicize some of the things that the library has acquired, notably a collection of posters from the First World War. This is the 2014, and for the next 4 years, we're assured that some of our taxes, probably rather less than some people think is necessary, probably more than should ever be spent on such purpose, will be spent helping Canadians remember a war which remains quite active and relevant in our memory. We who live in Quebec know what the Great War did to any dream of a single Canadian identity, how it robbed us of more than 60,000 men, launched the second biggest automobile industry in the world, which we've now forgotten about, I think, and also bankrupted our government, or merely robbed it of innovative initiatives for the next 20 years, until the Second World War. Second World War is one that I also study, although frankly I find it less engaging for me, for some reason, than the First World War, because the First World War was such a challenge to all involved, and because it was so utterly futile. Margaret MacMillan, who is a much better historian than I am, the daughter-in-law of the granddaughter of David Lloyd George, reminds us that the settlement of the First World War in each particular contributed to the Second World War. So what do we learn from history? Let's see if we can find out. I want to look at the way our governments and the leading citizens of the time passed on the messages they wanted us to hear about the war that was going on between 1914 and 18. To do that, I'm going to look at a collection of Great War posters, some of them at McGill, a few of them from my own collection, which I suppose in the way of such things, I think my wife would approve if I passed the bulk of them on to the McGill Library collection. But imagine, when you look at a poster, when you look at an ad on television tonight when you go home, you're engaged in a very one-way conversation. And fundamentally, that conversation is seeking from you the word, yes, damn right, good, let's go that way. I mean, whether they're advertising cigarettes or, you know, shoes or fashions, one kind or another, pills, they want you to give a positive answer. That's a one-sided conversation. The kind we have in commercial breaks in our television and radios. They're short, pointed messages and aimed at your grandparents, in the case of most that I'm going to be looking at, or perhaps even for some of your great-great-grandparents. I've chosen three categories with occasional overlap. I want to look at how governments tried to increase food production and curb consumption so we could export more. We will also see how the government tried to finance the war by co-opting its citizens' savings. First, however, we'll see how Ottawa and its allies across Canada struggled to persuade 500,000 of our 8 million Canadians in 1914-18 to forfeit their freedom and their families, to risk death and dismemberment in the most terrible and futile war in our national history. A war we would have to resume after only a generation, after the First World War had ended in what seemed at the time an unimaginable victory. First, however, I want to look, if I can, if my machinery works for me, to see how Canada persuaded its men to enlist. Here I go. First, it looked for posters from Great Britain. The British knew all about war, except possibly how to win it. And therefore, why not buy posters in England? And this is a common theme. The woman, whether it's his mother or his, I suspect more his mother than his wife, telling him to get enlisted, get off, your duty, man. There's another one which I have but could not reproduce for this audience. You've probably seen versions of it. Small child looking up at dad sitting there comfortably in his three-piece suit and said, "Dad, what did you do in the Great War?" "I had you." That's not the correct answer. The answer is I'm sure. So here are a few British posters. We all think I should go, but I've got a wife, I've got children, I've got a job. No, you should go. Arguably. Or the case of Edith Cavell. How many people have ever heard of Edith Cavell? She was a nurse, a British nurse, working in Belgium at the time. And she helped British soldiers who had been wounded and admitted to Belgium hospitals. She helped about three of them to escape, for which she was arrested by the Germans, and after a short trial, executed. Shocked the world. It tells you something about the world of 1914-15 that a single person, a woman, being killed could create a storm. Even the United States, totally neutral, somewhat sympathetic to the Germans, sent a message to Berlin that this must not be allowed to happen. It did. So the Cavell case is very British. You will, if you go to London, remember seeing outside the National Portrait Gallery a memorial to Edith Cavell. It's part of why you have to stop these horrible people. In this case, the attack to Canada of the 99th Battalion, Canadian Expeditionary Force, raised in the Western Ontario, Windsor, Chatham area. And then we did our own. 300,000 Canadians had enlisted by 1916. We needed more. Our king and country need you. Will you be one of these? And there's a human hand in civilian clothes, obviously trying to throttle the snake that is German. There is nothing very nice about this ad. It certainly expresses the desperation of a country that had gone through already 300,000 young men and needed at least 300,000 more. This was done by raising battalions. A battalion in army terms is about 1,000 soldiers under a lieutenant colonel. The 148th Battalion has a lot to say about McGill. It was the McGill Battalion, Colonel A. Montreal. McGill was the first university in Canada to establish a Canadian officers' training corps, which meant that young men who came to McGill, like those who are graduating now, simply got military training. Later on, those of you who have a Second World War post-war experience will realize it was a good way to earn the living you needed and the money for tuition for the next year. The income from COTC would cover next year's tuition and a lot of your other expenses. But in 1914-18, it was a chance to become an officer, to go to war. And Colonel McGee was not just recruiting soldiers. He makes the point in this ad that you become NCOs, non-commissioned officers. You won't just be ordinary crumb-bum soldiers. You'll be leaders, have privileges and positions. And there they are at their temporary headquarters, the old high school, 197 Peel Street, the other end of Peel. And Colonel McGee was active in the COTC when it was formed in 1912, and which became a very important institution at McGill when the war came, because the university wanted to prove its patriotism to a province that wasn't being very patriotic by being as active as possible in converting young men into young soldiers. Here's another
48th. This ugly-looking bird is one version of the enemy. Of course, there's a heroic McGill student in uniform winning that struggle. Here's one reminder that this is not just to get soldiers, it's to get officers. McGill students, of course, could join, but in the end, the 148th, as we'll see, just turned into yet another infantry recruiting machine, because the government decided that it would appoint university companies to recruit men from universities to replace bosses in what they regarded as special regiments. The Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry had been formed, for example, from British Army reservists who happened to have emigrated to Canada, who, having served 12 years in the British Army, were pretty well-trained soldiers, and who were wanted back. But they joined the Patricias because they could join and get Canadian wages. The British paid a shilling a day with stoppages. We paid $1.10 for a soldier who went into active service. And of course, the Patricians got the higher Canadian rate, which was not irrelevant to people after all. If you're leaving your family behind, you better have some money for them. But the 148th still continues to suggest that it's sort of more upper class, respectable. But gradually, the ads get just more and more standard stuff. The next man to put the I in fight is I. And you can see affiliated with the McGill University contingent of the Canadian Officer Training Corps at 197 Peel Street, the old Protestant High School, is where you go. I think this is a little hard to read, but am I right? Pointing bayonets at some non-existent figure. Yes, of course you are. You're good at all the list. And here's the final one. Why don't they come? You say, why is more people coming? The answer to that is yes, I should be playing a manly role. Women, of course, should encourage their sons and their husbands to join up. And here again, they don't offer you an officer's position, but you can become a sergeant. You start getting orders right away, best McGill fashion. Here's a little practical slide I put in. This is what you earn. If you're a sergeant or a corporal, age 18 to 45, you're going to earn more than you will as a private. Privates earn $1 a day, an extra 10 cents as field allowance, for a total of $1.10 a day. That's what a Canadian soldier would receive. In civil life, the phrase was becoming a little obsolete. The dollar a day is very good pay. That's what people said at the time of Confederation. Inflation worked its wicked way on salaries and wages and so on. So $1.10 was not great, but it was more than the British paid. And, of course, there has to be an appeal to French Canadians. And here you see some of the problems. Why would a French Canadian want to fight under the British flag? Well, the British ran things with the British War. Why would the British fight the war? Why would we fight for England? Did the English ever fight for us? Yeah, they fought over us to get us. So, what other ways are there of appealing to French Canadians? Here's the 178th Battalion. It's commanded by an ex-officer of the very first French Canadian unit to go overseas, which was recruited very rapidly, called the 22nd Battalion, which left in October, which was started in October of 1914 and left Canada in the spring of 1915. Colonel Girouard was sent back. He wasn't very good. And put in command and tried to organize another regiment of French Canadians. with six other officers who frankly had not exactly measured up to the 22nd Battalion. That's the boast. There will be six other officers of the 22nd, all of them back from the front. They will at least surely know something about war. Well, they've been sent back because they've been picked out because they didn't know anything about war. You wouldn't send your best officers back to Canada, would you? Not if you were smart. The other thing was, well, there's France in the war. It's absolutely crucially in the war. It's been invaded. Surely French Canadians love French Canada, or the France, and France. Well, we don't. We've had a bit about the secular charter in recent months. Quebec is not in favor of thinking about a France that is turning secular for a variety of reasons. And it's definitely not in favor when French Catholic priests come out to Quebec to, because they cannot be employed in France. People who were wiped out in their parishes can find a good parish, well financed and well full of devout French Canadians, who they will lecture on the stupidity and the evil and the wickedness of a secular France. The Third Republic is detestable to such people. So if it's detestable, why should we volunteer to go over and get killed for it? So this apparent fondness is not universal in French Canada. But how else do you persuade people to go to war? So the answer to this question is no. It's not good advertising. Well, I'll come back to the English. There is Mother. We all know the original of this. Fight for her. The Germans have been killing Belgian women, and plus our old Edith Cavell, if you're British. I would hate to say the Irish respond to sentiment, but evidently, the designer of this poster thinks so. Come with the Irish Canadian Rangers, an overseas battalion to be raised in Montreal. There they are as the Irish Rangers, 199th. They will have a sportsman's company. There you see a jump into your place in the sportsman company of the 199th under Colonel Treaty. There's the 244th Battalion, also from Montreal, which boasts that it is going to give you the proper equipment. This is a boast which I discovered, my own research, was absolutely false. There wasn't proper equipment for these regiments. They had to wait till it came from the factories. And until then, they might as well wear the fedora as well as wear a cap they don't own. And as for the rifle, everything you need to be a soldier included a Ross rifle, which couldn't, it was in fact a remarkably accurate weapon on a rifle range, if it was clean. Somehow in the mud of France, it got dirty. And somehow in the imperial relationship, which we all admired, proved of in those days, the bullets provided by the British for the 303 Ross rifle didn't fit. There is a phenomenon called the Woolwich Inch. Woolwich is the Royal Arsenal. And the Woolwich Inch was slightly different from the inch you may have had as a kid on your ruler, or that you still use as a measure. It was a little bit, trifling bit bigger. But when you're trying to load a weapon with a straight pull, that is, you have to yank the bullet out of the chamber. The bullet has been fired, it's expanded very slightly, it was already too big for the chamber. You've got to practically put the rifle down, kick it, to open the rifle to reload it. So if they did have Ross rifles to spare, they were not much good. They were, however, just like the Avro Arrow Canadian criticize anything that was Canadian made. Besides, it could hit the target if you could get it loaded, and if you could fire it, and if you could hold it very steadily. But it was a bit longer than any other rifle, too. And as you marched along the trench, it stuck out. Anyway, I could go on, but I won't. Here's another regiment we know better, the Black Watch, which had three battalions from Montreal overseas at one time. The 13th had gone with the 1st Division, the 42nd was part of the 3rd Division, the 73rd was part of the 4th and final Canadian Division overseas. Three English-speaking regiment battalions from one city, Montreal. We were a metropolis in those days and could provide it. Now they just want 250 more men to be sent overseas immediately, without training, without anything, because they're needed. Once again, we come back to the other gender, to the women of Canada. You've read that the Germans, what the Germans did in Belgium. Have you thought what this would happen if they invaded our country? Rape and murder. And so on it goes. Arguments that attempt to persuade young men that this is why they have to join. Stop this happening. Well, do you think anybody believed that this was going to happen imminently? The battle is not exactly going very well in France for either side. Are they going to really race across the Atlantic from wave to wave to land in Montreal and start carrying on like they were in Belgium? You've got to be a little bit of a fiction reader. What about French Canadians? Come with us in the 150th Battalion. Help to win victory for the French cock over the Prussian eagle. And we can offer you Lieutenant Colonel Gaffey at the arsenal of the 65th Cachemillier Montréal. She's still there on West East End. A recruiting poster that got men for the 150th Battalion, which never got enough to go overseas. And here we see again the Allies. French Canadians, in the hour of the greatest peril that we have ever experienced, our country and humanity as a whole. Forget us. Do we forget the traditions which have made the glory and pride of our race? Well, this didn't work particularly well either. Think about it. The British recruiting poster that probably is the best known is the one with Kitchener and his finger pointing at you. And the answer is, Britain needs you. And here's a regiment that's called itself, here in Montreal, Kitchener's Own. Colonel McRoby at the high school barracks on Peel Street took over from the 148th, but it failed to get enough men. This is important. Is that going to persuade a French Canadian that this is my business? I don't think so. Here's a cartoon, not so much a poster. Perth and Kitchener, are those in Quebec, Daddy? Says the little boy with the underhanging lip. His father has also got the same kind of lip, but is rather cross at the question, because of course Perth and Kitchener are not in Quebec, they're in Ontario. There were demonstrations. Kitchener was the town of Berlin. German-speaking, German-settled, German-proud. Having a pretty tough time in the war. And the Canadian militia was having a pretty tough time getting recruits. Partly because the recruits they did get would go raging through the town of Berlin, smashing things, and getting drunk, breaking the windows. Why not? Because these people are German. They speak German. We all know Germans are subhuman. We should destroy them. Nice people. And partly, there was also another riot in Perth, not that far away. So
is that what we really expect from Ontario, or is it what we expect to happen in Quebec? Here's a song. I've never heard it played on the CBC or anywhere else, but there is a waltz ballad, the song with a good moral, or a moral. Her, she is the one who wants you to join. Another French-Canadian poster, this for a regiment being raised in the townships of the 178th, to die for King, for the fatherland, and for humanity. Not exactly a powerful or effective appeal, although for pure Canadians, this does at least rise on the French-Canadian belief in rural life, ruralité. Another musical piece, The Battle of the Somme, written by A.W. Hughes, a march to be played on the piano. Not exactly the most military kind of music, but still something that you could probably practice in your living room. And here's an alternative. You could go as a bush worker or a sawmill worker and join the forestry corps. That sounds not so dangerous, unless you're bad with the saw. And many Canadians did that service in the First World War. Edith Cavell again, this time from the 221st Regiment, Battalion, rather. This infamous act must be avenged. Right? Anybody in favor? Anybody opposed? Jump another one. 215, the fate of the empire, these are for Ontario, really. The fate of the empire depends on you. Come with us in the 215. I should say that the Canadian Corps consisted of four infantry divisions. Each division had 12 infantry battalions, and in fact, 48 battalions were all the Canadian Corps needed. But the 60,000 casualties, fatal casualties of the First World War, meant that each battalion had to be replaced at least once, some of them two or three times. The Patricias, still part of our Canadian Army, were annihilated four times in the course of the First World War. When that happens, without going into details, it's not the safety first kind of soldier who's the first to get killed. It's those who offer themselves by charging over the edge of the trench into no man's land. So you lose your best men. And maybe not your idea of the best men, but they're the ones who want to fight. So they have to be replaced. So these battalions, like the 250, if they raise enough money, will be shipped as far as England. Then the officers will lose their jobs, and the soldiers will be distributed as needed in France. So it's a bit of a fraud to say you're going along with your buddies in the 250, because your buddies are going to be spread across the whole Canadian Corps. Eventually, by 1918, at least it's regional, by province. So if you came from Ontario, you'll probably be sent to a battalion itself, largely composed of Ontarians. But that's not a perfect rule. The other thing is, the scrap of paper. How many people remember that phrase? The Germans had signed a treaty, as had the British, as had the French, that Belgium would be created out of the south end, the Catholic end of the Netherlands, and they would guarantee its security. When the Germans want to invade Belgium to get around the French defenses and sort of have a flank attack, they invade Belgium. That's part of their strategy. And they say, well, that agreement is just a scrap of paper. We forgot about it. So, back to 1830. That was 90 years ago. Who the hell cares? Well, of course, our side did, because Britain went to war ostensibly to protect Belgium. So the scrap of paper was proof that we were honorable people who kept our agreements a century later, not like the dirty Germans. organization that was born in Montreal, the Canadian Patriotic Fund. Actually, there were patriotic funds for the War of 1812, for the Crimean War, and for the Boer War, and for the First World War. Soldiers who don't earn any money, like, for example, the issue came up in Montreal. European countries had universal military service. You spent 2 years, eventually the French made you stay for 3 years in the army as part of growing up. And if there was a war, you would be called back to serve to the colors. The French army, therefore, was part of a French man's life. Women were not included in this responsibility of citizenship. And when they were called in 1914, many of them had been, the Montreal police force, for example, was dominated by young Frenchmen who served in the French army, done their 3 years, and because they were disciplined and could stand up straight and so on, they seemed to make ideal policemen. So the Montreal police force was devastated when all these men did their duty, reported to the French consulate in Montreal, camped out on what is now the square near Hudson's Bay Company, the old Morgan's Square. They were going to leave their families, their wives, their children, with virtually no money. The French army paid, I think, a franc a day for a soldier, which is about the equivalent of 15 cents. So there was no money left over to feed the families. And French-Canadian businessmen decided that they would establish a charitable fund to support soldiers' families. This spread to English Canada. When English Canada went to war, Britain went to war on midnight, 4th of August 1914, we were in the war that minute, because Canada's decisions of that sort were made in Great Britain, not here. The Patriotic Fund, of course, was very relevant because at $1.10 a day, you had to make, if you were a married man eventually, you had to pay part of your salary over to your wife. But that meant out of $1.10 a day, maybe 25 cents would go home to your wife and children if it reached it. So the Patriotic Fund was established here in Montreal and gradually spread across the country, though the founders of it, Sir Herbert Ames, who was the Ames Boot Company, and was the founder, he took the idea because he studied the case of poverty and knew the need. And so the Patriotic Fund spread from coast to coast as a social welfare measure privately financed. And in order to get private donors, you'll appreciate this as donors to the library, the donors had to be satisfied that the money was not being squandered. And therefore, in Montreal, to put it very literally, the ladies of Westmount would supervise the mothers of Saint-Henri by visiting their homes and making sure that they hadn't wasted their Patriotic Fund allowance on new clothes or piano or some other extravagant thing that a working class woman shouldn't possibly have. This went through the war, and it's, as you can see, a little bit touchy. A whole lot touchy. When it got to British Columbia, women were actually organized in riots in the streets. And men would not go overseas because they didn't want to leave their wives to this kind of treatment by the rich of Vancouver, or the rich wives of Vancouver. So in the Second World War, there is no Patriotic Fund. For the first time, we don't have one. The Red Cross do it. I think they also got into a bit of trouble because I remember as a young soldier, the Red Cross was not a charity I was supposed to be very fond of. It's all part of it. But the Patriotic Fund is one way of financing our war effort. And remembering that here's a Toronto demonstration these four mothers gave to their country, 28 brave sons.
absentee that never came back. People are using the war to make sales, to whack razors. Here you see these heroic looking men, most of them from the British Army, but some one Italian up there, Augusto Guerri, with feathers in his hat, clean fighters. You need a Gillette bladed blade, no electric razors in the trenches, thank you very much. More Stanfield's underwear. Why is this a warlike thing? Because the mother wears it too, because she's going to a factory job making munitions, just as the man is going overseas. Finally, even Wrigley's gun. There's a heroic pilot taking off to survey the enemy lines, strengthened in his mouth by having Wrigley's chewing gum. Here's another French Canadian ad, this for artillery. French Canada was a small enough community that a name like Thomas Bien was actually known. And very often, French Canadian regiments report who their colonel is because that will help recruit. The McConnell Ferguson advertising agency is reminding people in the text of this ad that probably in your firm, the best salesman has probably gone and enlisted. Now we as an advertising company could take over your sales problem and by advertising replace the guy who's gone off to the war. So everybody has an angle. The war is going to make business. And frankly, it probably made Canadians more prosperous than they'd ever been. Happy man today is the man at the front. Well, you may judge that for yourselves, but the 73rd Royal Highlanders are part of the Black Watch organization, which remains one of Montreal's proudest militia regiments. Moving away from Montreal, here we have Gillette's safety razor, needed for his chin, but also needed to buy advertising space for recruiting. The war was sent. Well, are you going to fight your own battles or are you going to let someone else fight them for you? Here's 126th Peel Battalion, my old part of Canada, looking for men. Patriotic Fund, another Montreal battalion, the Canadian Grenadier Guards, trying to raise a battalion, but strictly from the English. Most of the Montreal recruiting was done in English or English-speaking Montrealers. Three questions from the Webb and Peel County, my old county in Montreal, in Ontario. Do you know that you as a woman are deterring your son or husband from joining up? Do you know that, this is very hard to do, but when the war is over and whatever your husband or your son did in the Great War is going to make his head rise or fall in shame? If he didn't serve, he's going to be humiliated. Won't you help send a man to join the army today? Women of Peel County, why won't you? There's a battalion, a local battalion, right here in Brampton for you to join. An overseas kilted battalion. You look different in a kilt. You look more manly, strangely enough. Kitchener said the war will last 3 years and will be won by the last million men. They'll come home, too, safely. The third year has commenced. Join today. McGill wasn't the only university busy collecting male students to go overseas. Here's Queen's University, our competitor in so many things, raising guys who could wear kilts. Financing the war by borrowing from Canadians. The war effort was
conservative government in Ottawa under Sir Robert Borden that was basically going to finance it by borrowing. After all, this was a special expenditure. You couldn't expect taxpayers to normally run a great war along with building railways, helping out with government. The money would be borrowed. The money would be borrowed not in Britain, because the British institutions were overcrowded with needs for their own country, but for the first time in New York. Canadian governments had avoided the American money market. Now they would go there with enthusiasm. And with some sneaking devils. Interest rates were higher. Better to borrow from Canadians themselves. What a weird idea. Would Canadians lend their money to their own government? Well, in a war, they'll give their lives. Why wouldn't they give their money? The effort was made. So, magic baking powder helped pay for this ad, donated the victory loan in 1918. Helped to catch Huns. There's a Hun caught by the ear by a large policeman and his dog, a dachshund, as we all know, typical German dog. Long, thin, and nasty looking, sharp bark. Victory bonds will shorten the war. Raising money from the people. Raising the medicine in France. If these French women can drive the plow, why can't Canadian women lend money through victory loans? That mystery-looking fellow is supposedly a Canadian soldier. I think he looks more French than Canadian, but I can't say anything more about that. They will win if you subscribe to the victory bond loan of 1918. Well, that's sweet. Subscribe to the Victory Bond, and there, if you look in the foreground, is a mast from a hospital ship called the Landovery Castle, which had been torpedoed by a German submarine in the background. And while it was heading back to Europe, it wasn't carrying wounded and sick soldiers from Europe, it was going back. Nurses were aboard and nurses drowned. The notion of women dying in war was intolerable. It was a proof of ability beyond belief. After the war, surely it's an end to victory box. No, it isn't. We still got to bring the soldiers home. The government in 1917 had promised, the words I remember very well, full reestablishment for all Canadian soldiers. That was the promise of the 1917 conscription election. How do you do that with a government that is now up to its eyeballs in debt? The answer is you go deeper and you borrow from Canadians. At a lower rate than if you got to borrow on the money market. So, here's another way. We turn to the food industry. We are an exporting country. This is a British ad. The Empire Marketing Board is telling Brits to buy Canadian food. There's something, if you could figure it out, it's not intended to be easy. The National Service Board of Canada is reminding Canadians to help maintain their financial freedom by lending to their own government. This is actually a French ad, because the French too were doing it. They were borrowing from the United States when the United States was not yet at war. The second loan for national defense. Subscribe, says the soldier. Patriotic ad, Canadian but British in origin, the bulldog fighting nasty birds that come from Germany, and a scrap of paper. We had allies. including Serbia, which is, after all, the first country that falls under enemy attack in 1914. Serbian war pictures were displayed in Piccadilly in August. They come to Canada later on, but I haven't found an ad for them. Silver bullets. You have them in your pockets. They're called dimes, nickels, quarters, along with the pennies. Silver bullets are, everybody can contribute. Little kids can buy or savings bags. And you can use your change to win the war. You can buy thrift stamps at the Swosie, at the post office. We let them at the back, we let them at the front. And for the first time in our history, we have income tax. It's only for the war. It will end when the war is over. Trust me, don't you? Well, that's what it serves. I mean, of course, you are, if you're very rich, you don't have to pay. It's but if you're very poor, you don't have to pay either. The Prime Minister of Canada in 1917 got a salary of $8,000 a year. Compare that to what Mr. Harper is now taking home, even as a pension. That $8,000 puts the Prime Minister in the tax range, much less than that isn't there. But still, this is the beginning of the income tax in Canada. Not everybody thought this was wonderful. This is a Liberal ad for the 1917 election, and in virtue of free speech and fairness, I've included it. Typical, there are Tory cabinet ministers, Prime Minister Borden, Bob Rogers, Mike Colborne, Cochrane, and Sir Thomas White, all getting rich because of wartime taxes. And there are soldiers and women volunteers keep the home fires burning. You can also help, if you're ladies, by running sales, selling your products, things you make, and that goes to patriotic fund. $5 for $4. You're going to get $5 back for every $4 you lend. I haven't been able to calculate this in reality, but that's what the sign says, so it must be true, right? This lovely little slightly racist ad is a reminder that Native people have been contributing to the patriotic fund. What I also discovered is that Native families did not benefit from the Canadian patriotic fund, because after all, they didn't really need it, did they? Living on the land as they do. But this is very much part of the patriotic fund propaganda. Free Chief actually did write a letter, which I've seen, it's in all of America. Now we're into food preservation. If you take farmers and put them in uniform, they're not there to farm. Who's going to do the work? Well, there's the boys, soldiers of the soil, better than the Boy Scouts. Very much like the Boy Scouts, except for straw hat as opposed to a felt one. We're saving you, you save food. Well-fed soldiers will win the war. Bit simple, but nice idea. There's a nice time to add for this time of year. Make this summer's garden, provide next winter's vegetables. Particularly like this one, hoarded flour, hoarded sugar. Are you breaking the law? Yes, you are. And the Food Board order against food hoarding. Remember that in those days, before refrigerators and deep freezes, there wasn't a heck of a lot of food you could preserve for very long periods of time. You probably already experienced one way or another, but you could try.
There they are. Shadow of a policeman passing the door. Don't do it. Healthy vegetables. I like the spotting because he thinks that's perfectly true. Say wheat, beet, fats for our soldiers and allies. I'm not sure the fats would actually go down too well these days. There's something for you. Look at the way the butter is shrinking. Canada must do better than make that much butter. He's only sold 6 million pounds to Britain last year. Two years ago. Keep Britain's butter plate full. Make money for Canada. Don't eat it yourself. Send it overseas. And don't outgrow the bread and milk habit. Bread and milk is good for you. Butter isn't. Notice how Eaton's catalog, even as the war is coming to an end, 1919, using a patriotic theme. The Canadian flag, not the most patriotic perhaps, it could have been used in the Union Jack, that's the Canadian flag as it existed, all the provinces represented in the shield. Or for thrift stamps, and this is repeating an earlier one. Are you relieved with Pharisee, those fat rich people eating, enjoying themselves, helping the Kaiser? We thank for it. We have to save food. Canadian wheat. To sell our wheat, it's necessary to subscribe to the Victory Bond, Victory Loan campaign. Bone, fat, so on. You should have a bucket by your sink and keep it for when the kids come around to collect it for explosives. Wartime ads. And basically, to beat the Hun and vote the right way for a Union government of liberals and conservatives who believe in conscription. And further measure. Most of this is done because they can't regulate individuals, but they can regulate restaurants. Restaurants will not supply beef or bacon on 2 days of the week. 5 days they can supply it, but they can't otherwise. And restaurants are reasonably easy to regulate, manage, oversee, not homes. Anyway, that's the show. Gone on rather longer than I probably should have, but any questions or comments? Yes?
Has anyone ever studied how effective this advertising campaign was?
Yes.
And
no.
No?
It wasn't.
It wasn't.
Well, it's relative.
Yeah.
It depends on public opinion. And that's why the recruiting to French Canadians, which ignored the nature of French Canadian feelings at the time, was so absolutely lamentable. But on other issues, like hoarding, your neighbors would be, nervous about your neighbors. Because after all, if they were true Brits, like we should all be as Canadians, they might tell on you, and your reputation would be shot. But if you were Canadien Français, your reputation might be shot. Why should they be interfering with your lives? So it depended. But the weight of public opinion was pretty narrow and pretty focused. And that's what this advertising knows. They're not telling you, at least for the most part, there is a war on. And the pressure of public opinion is that that war should be won. And if they say this will win the war, you better do it. Public opinion. And getting a yes answer from everybody. Okay. Let's take your comment. Yes, sir.
The Czarist side, are there any posters from the Czarist Russian side or from the German side that have been collected by the Guild?
I haven't been given access to any. I suspect there were such posters, but I suspect they're also got a big language barrier.
Yeah. Actually, there are some German war posters in the collection.
Okay.
And they're going to be part of an exhibition in the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They certainly were posters. They were as publicity conscious as we were, more so. But I just haven't. To assume something that French and English were the languages communicate to this crowd, certainly.
Yes, where people would find these posters in the streets or magazines or?
Well, billboards and posters on brick walls, which were quite common.
There were a lot, or
there would be some, but after all, people now do it with, what do you call that, painting messages on walls, graffiti. And those spaces are available for people to paste posters. That's how advertising was done for selling whatever houses, cars, or food.
Were there any French posters urging French Canadians not to go to war?
I haven't in my life encountered it. I've looked for them because it would be interesting. But I think the posters that were done for recruiting were so inadequate that they probably helped achieve. I mean, they really insulted Quebec while they're simply not answering to that kind of message. English Canadians were. It's a period, as I said at the outset. It's when our vision of having one Canada really breaks down. And I don't know if it's come back. I wish it would. But you've got to make a lot of concessions to have that happen.
Who did these posters?
Who? Well, it depends
on... Did the Canadian government produce them? Did the fund, the private fund that was raising money, did they produce them?
They produce them. The patriotic funds produce posters locally in my province and for campaigns. They had a campaign every year during the war, and they ran their own posters.
Was there really an advertising industry?
Yeah.
One advertising firm, but did it constitute a successful industry in
hundred
years ago?
I think so. For their time, for their expectations, and for very little money. But as I said at the outset, first thing Canada does is get posters from Great Britain in large numbers and spread those around. And they succeed in raising the first 100, perhaps even 300,000 that are achieved by 1960. But I think we had an advertising industry, one that I haven't personally studied, but it certainly seems to be there in its own different way, using the paper medium that were available at that time, no radio, no television, no internet.
Of course.
Yeah, sure.
So, as the war went on, you know, it became clear, I guess, people who were there, what was actually happening over there, what was happening reported to people?
No. As little as possible. Because, of course, war is hell. And people are, the word gets back, but it's certainly not enjoyed. But then it's a challenge to face all the war part we live. Germans are so terrible, so vicious, so evil. I mean, I brought this to, I'm going to pass this around among you. Raymaker's cartoons. Raymaker was a Dutch cartoonist who published cartoons, particularly graphic kind. And it's taken up, his work was taken up by a British magazine called Land and Field and printed and published and distributed. Much as by the New Yorker. And they're pretty
ghastly pictures, I think. And they're anti-German. I mean, it's Belgium's response. And he is a Dutch cartoonist, regards Belgium as his concern. And what I've said has been relatively mild compared to what he has to say about Germans.
Does all of this attempts at propaganda, did it not lead ultimately to the creation of the National Film Board, first and foremost as a propaganda instrument for the Second World War?
It did in the Second World War, yeah. But I think that Canada's war art, which is another story, the war artists included one photographer. That was all they thought they had to afford. And I think his work was, well, he did a lot of it, but it's pretty boring stuff. And the visual, artistic work is much more impactful. But photography existed. And as I've said occasionally, I was raised, as my dad had kept the Illustrated War News, which was, you remember a British magazine called the Illustrated London News? Well, it's wartime, First World War version was the Illustrated War News. It was wider than it was tall and had beautiful pictures, well, very well produced pictures on very glossy paper. And that was part of my education growing up. It seemed to be a huge bookshelf in our family home in China, which was an army H hut, where it had plenty of space, length anyway, not width. And there was the Illustrated War News. I sat there night after night, reading it, looking at the pictures, and reading the caption. And it was very problematic. But no longer it's not. Oh, yes?
Richard, could you just say a couple of words about the website?
Oh, well, certainly. There's a website for the Neil War Poster Collection that's accessible to anyone. And it's not everything that we have, but it's both the First and Second War of Canadian war posters. Some of them were quite, well, some of them we saw this evening, and it's well worth having a look at.
I just want to make a comment, Richard, please. Correct me if I'm wrong, talk about this probably on a weekly basis, but I think we're also looking at digitizing the McGill Daily back to issue one, and you'll see sort of the McGill version of the First World War. And I think there's a big effort being put into that right now that the library's under.
As I remember looking at the Daily, it was much more pro-government and pro-war effort. Second War, and certainly more recently, which reflects the way people thought. We English-speaking Canadians were British Canadians, and don't fool around with that. It's rather frustrating and narrowing and so on, but that's the way they were. They moved in different directions. And the war made it very hard for us to become, once again, what we, our ancestors in perhaps dreamed of as a single country. French Canadians felt betrayed. So when I come to write the Swabie Dev again in Francais, I've got a very different mood when I come to the War of the Wars than I did when I wrote the 19th century history. So, anyway, thank you very much for your patience. I enjoyed it.
Visual aspects, the propaganda, the fact that there wasn't much truth in advertising. The Canadian government didn't traffic so much in truth either, I guess, at that point. Who knew? We now do. So thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Des, very, very much for preparing this and for giving me so much information. Thank you.
Too much, probably.
No. No, I love it. Dr. Richard Prever is the librarian of the Rare Books and Special Collections. What is the website address again, Richard?
Well, you oh gosh. Well, I can
share it with you after this meeting. Canadian War Posters, I think, would be www.
You get
Well, you have to go to Digital Collections, so that's
ask Mr. Google. Right.
Yes, Google.
Ask Mr. Google. Anyhow, thank you again, thank you for coming, thank you to Des, backed out into the rain. I understand the rain, did you know the rain was so